everyone. I think we'll start because we are already late. We're terribly behind schedule. We are going to start with the panel discussion on academic publishing. This panel discussion is moderated, is chaired by Mr. Vivek Mehra, who is Managing Director and CEO of Sage India. Mr. Mehra joined Sage India in 2005, in September 2005, and became Managing Director and CEO in the 1st of December 2006. And since then, under his stewardship, Sage has grown tremendously. Its revenues have grown, its profitability has grown. And Mr. Mehra is probably a keen student of the academic publishing industry in India, so it was only appropriate that we made him the chair of this session. Over to you, Mr. Mehra.
Thank you. Good morning. Great to be in Goa, Leonard. Thank you for the invitation. I think we should begin with spending a couple of minutes on understanding the scale of academic publishing. I looked at the note that Leonard circulated as a theme around this panel discussion, but academic publishing actually is quite a lot more. When we talk about publishing as a whole, and broadly divided into fiction and non-fiction, the perception is that fiction is overwhelmingly large, and the truth is it's not so. It's probably an even balance, and that balance is not really visible. We're told we are probably the most boring lot, the most dense lot. But grudgingly, everybody, you know, turns around and says that can't do without you guys anyway. Towards the end of this session, I'll talk a little bit about what's happening in the 21st century. But in the current panel that we have, we represent a very diverse group of people, all loosely called academic publishers from their different backgrounds. So each one's going to spend about 15 minutes within each person and introduce themselves. And then make a presentation or talk about their area of expertise. The most important part of the discussion is that it should be a discussion, not a monologue from the high chair or the low chair, whichever way you want to look at it. So to do that, I hope we have sufficient time for question and answers. And from our part, I certainly hope that we ask sufficient amount of questions or provide sufficient amount of data to be able to get you to ask the question. So the first speaker is the gentleman sitting on my left, Sandeep Goswami. He's going to introduce himself and then take it from there.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
We can, talk a lot about academic publishing, but one is at a loss when you address an audience of this kind as to what they should be talking about. Should be telling your stories about the business you do or what's happening around the world, and that would always be a dilemma for this kind of panel here. I think it's up to you what you want to get out of us, and we'd be quite grateful if you shorten our presentation by asking your questions. Otherwise, talking about our business and 15 minutes is a very small, short time, possibly keep talking 15 days at this point. That's what we are all, I guess, in our positions trying to do. Talk. Right. My name is Sanjeev Goswami, and I've been in the publishing business for pretty long. Started my career just after my college at the university, back in 1983. Worked for McGraw-Hill. Initially joined the industry as an education representative. That's where the openings were in the industry. Then short period, grew up the ladder. It was very tough in those years. We didn't easily get promotions. Today it's a game of growing out of money and designations. What's different? After about 13 years with McGraw-Hill, I moved on to OUP as the director for academic sales and marketing. attractive and spin upon me and my sponsor and started the whole operation for the house. And set up this company over the last 15 years. So that's what I did. But that's, you know, in academic publishing, we sometimes say that the whole publishing business is about massaging of egos. So I've done enough of my own ego massage. Let's talk a bit about the company that I represent. Of course, Vivek is going to talk about general publishing business, but you know, where do we come from? This is the real stuff. It doesn't matter who's speaking to you, but from the company platform, it's important. What kind of business that I represent, and what are the developments that we're tracking related to the kind of business that we're in? The Springer is a very old publishing house, very well known in Europe, especially in Germany, where we were founded in 1842. Maybe about 180 years of existence, started with publishing political pamphlets, like everybody did. And then, very soon, around the 1890s, going into a more scientific kind of publisher. We are known for producing high-end content, research, academic, and beyond, sometimes, many times, reaching into areas which are fantasy or science. So, not a very exciting dish to sell. I guess I represent the most boring side of what we describe. And this boring side is 2,500 scientific as well as human science journals. We're no longer just a scientific publisher. We publish four. But our publications in the scientific world dominate over the human science content we represent. So with 2,500 journals, we are neck and neck with Elsevier Science, which is as you know, the largest journals produced in the world and the most successful in terms of revenues. So we've caught up with numbers. We have a long way to go to catch up with revenues. We are also the largest producer of books in the world. We publish close to 5,000 new titles every year. So in terms of content, it's doing massive factory of content. And just to give it a little more color and to your imagination, we produce 13 to 16,000 pages of knowledge each day. So that's how huge the content creation process in the company is. We employ about 6,000 people, 5.5 is increased because we're always recruiting in India. That's the favorite place for all publishers, I think, all businesses. And one third of our global workforce is based in India. We have four companies in India. Springer India, which is the business arm of the global company where we sell various products and also source content. We have another company called Springer Control Services, which is a company which helps put together, as part of the global team, major encyclopedias, multi-volume sets, the massive stuff that we do, real high-end research and reference material. These two entities I manage based in Delhi. We have another company called SPS, which is Production and Typesetting, based in Chennai. We employ about 3,000 people there. We do typesetting not just for Springer, but for also our dear competitors, Elsevier, We have a fourth company in Pune called Press Publishing. Press does typesetting, market research, animation, design, and typesetting in languages other than English. Dutch and German is typesetting in India, a form of communication. There's 700 people work there. So this is what the Springer presence is. On the content side, it's nice to say that we are a respected publisher, but what brings us respect is our authors. And we are in a unique business that our content providers are also our customers. So it's a very, very unique business and an exciting business that we're in. 21% of Nobel Prize winners are Springer authors. That means about 200 so far are have published with Springer at one point or the other. I've already talked to you about Springer here. So now, this is what the company is, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that are related to the business of my company, I guess. I'm more competent doing rather than making guesses about how the world is going and what the future will be. So it's very difficult for the executives like us to make predictions, which we try to do. I hope we're right. All right, the presentation that I have put together is basically talk about the role of STM publishers, market trends, the change, what led to the change in the STM world, libraries, products, business models, publishing workflows, of course, the backend changed. There was lots of speculation how the backend changes. It's a mind-boggling process. Just putting the old days to publishing in place. It is a different world altogether than what we've seen in traditional publishing. Dissemination methods have changed. Digital rights management is a big topic. There are views that the content creators have. As far as my company is concerned, we do not have DRM. Because we are now an e-first company, and our idea of providing content is to push usage and visibility as far as possible and not restrict it. So we don't have DRM, but that's a controversial topic in the industry. We can debate that. Return on investments, is it working? The e-revolution. And of course, guesswork. Well, this is how you could possibly plot the academic market. The top of the triangle, the deep blue is where Springer publishes. That's our core market. And also the yellow part, which is applied researchers. So that's where we publish. And Elsevier publishes their journals. So that's where the journals and the high reference market is. And then you have the secondary user group, as we call them, which are PhD students, developers, a select set of graduate students. And that's where the relevance of our content hopefully ends, unless we have a live from us talking and comment yesterday that there's so much of hunger for content here that I find undergraduate engineering students reading journal articles, which is really not comprehensible because that's not the level of content that is required.
And then, coming down,
we have the undergraduate students market. That's where the BTECs and the college students and all the university courses within the college students within medical colleges, MBBS, that's the sector we're talking about. So that, I think, fairly is the plot of the academic market if you're going to do it. And that's for another, that one needs to read books before one can understand scientific journals. That's why it's plotted in such a way that it's, the triangle is upwards. Well, what's the role of a scientific publisher? There's research going on all over the place, and scientific content being created, scientist-like content, researchers-like content, academics-like content, sometimes students-like content. The STM publisher approaches all these content creators, or sometimes commissions these content creators to create content according to a specific need, or looks at material available which is new and creates knowledge. So content sourcing is a very important aspect of STM publishers' activities. We do lots of activities, model workshops, trainings, and teach people how to write articles, how to develop scientific material, and kind of handhold them through the whole process of developing manuscripts and submitting to the publisher. Another important process which is key to the scientific publishing world is the peer review process. You need to define what is publishable and what should be disseminated widely as reasonably authoritative, factually correct, and which has the ability to create knowledge amongst the readers. The peer review process is extremely important, otherwise Vivek would write something and I'd pull it up.
And we'd sell it and make a lot of money.
It's an independent, impartial peer review system. It's necessary to segregate important information from the draft. production processes, author reviews, approvals, in the new world, metadata, tagging, design, coding for web disseminations, and then the product is created in the form of a brain learning. Then the responsibility for marketing it, various new pull and push methodologies have developed, new lingo in the marketing world. Finally, they've given up on brandings and all sorts of wasteful expenditure that we all did not think or focus towards what's happening in the scientific world and what really creates value for the person who is close to those marketing efforts and no longer in the air, used as exercises of releasing endless amount of healthy catalogs, which nobody reads. So marketing has changed, publishers have also done things changing, and there's a lot of effort and money which goes into creating all these changes. And then, of course, the dissemination of
Modems, mediums, aggregators, direct sales, websites, mobile applications, the Amazons of the world, networking and consortia. The whole way that we do business has completely changed. The new set of people that we deal with, direct institutional contacts, coming together with consortia, the business models are up to one's creativity, what you want to create, and how you want to reach your customers. Another important aspect which we never really talk about in presentations is the role that publisher as a business house plays in collecting the sales that we make. The money back, the real revenue, very difficult. We talked about it yesterday, how difficult it is to sell books and how more difficult it is to also get paid for it. That's another important role publisher does. And then we've tried to fairly disseminate royalties, and these activities are then supervised by global accounting authenticators. So that's our role. Okay, I'm go fast. All right. And there are essential services, publishing technologies, functionalities, indexing, abstracting services. Electronic repositories have become a new need for the publishing business, metadata management, market analysis, feedback, so on. The STM market is not, though it's regarded as a consistent growth market, it always grows, it doesn't have very many swings. It's quite consistent in its growth. It's not also alarming on both sides. She grows at. Skip this, more on how the products are growing and percentages, it's more for the academic oriented. Well, what's changed is the P first to E first, especially in our business. And the business models have changed from to direct channels, libraries directly. Of course, the booksellers are now worried what's the future. So the future for the booksellers, especially in the STM, high-end STM world, is course evolving, and we'll have to look at new methods of engaging with our customers in the future, because
the value is diminishing. Direct channels, aggregators.
I'm giving you 20. No, it's not working. None of them are working. All of them are dead now. Yeah. Please shout. Sanjeev?
That's something different.
Maybe I'll try without the mic. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can.
All right, let's then keep going. Yeah, the P2E conversion has also changed a lot in the academic publishing world, from conventional to innovative business models, diversified portfolios to scientific focus, and from local to global operations. Extremely important, you know, kind of getting intertwined into one world. And the internet is binding us together to it. Of course, the direct channels have appeared. Publishers now are beginning to deal directly with institutions. It makes sense because it's an ongoing partnership. It's not sell a few books and go away and then not see him anymore. It's kind of networking him into a licensing contract for e-content and so on. Indirect channels. Agents have become sellers of content from collecting just journals orders. Third-party vendor channels have developed. Needs of users are immense in the EU world. I mean, it's very difficult to measure up to their expectations. So as a business house, you have to limit your offerings to a certain sensible way that you can also manage its administration and sensibly do the business and not create chaos to bring you down. So you need a variety of agents or aggregators or third-party vendors to provide you with services. So that's how you have My Library ebooks, and also the desire to reach this information into new markets, which are not core to our business. Well, what really brought about the rapid change in the academic high-end publishing was technology. On one hand, the internet provided us this big container to store a huge amount of content, and on the other side, it also made visible a lot of content which is not visible in the past in its print form. And the users then became aware and demanded it in a different format. And what there were two other factors which actually drove the usage of this content. One was the search engine capabilities. I mean, reference content is never read cover to cover. Novels and textbooks are read cover to cover. Reference content is always you pick a certain section and then you move on and cross-check.
the search crossref big container works fantastically well in a P environment. So that really brought the change. And of course, the research output, and people are writing more. A lot more publishing happening today than it was in the past. A lot of research is going on across the world. On the back-end side, everything is now digitized. You know, the moment we think of an idea, it's on the system. And then there are very sophisticated production workflows with software assisting the manuscript development, and its progress through the production system, copy editing, and also vendor management within that production workflow. They also electronically connect to the production workflow and provide you services, designing, tagging, uploading, and so on and so forth. So the whole process of producing an electronic content is also at the back end completely digitized. And it, what it then throws out is a PDF, and whether you print it into a print book or you collect it into a package and sell an electronic license to your users or your institute, it really doesn't matter to the publisher anymore. We are in the business of creating content, and we deliver according to the preference of the customers. Well, I think I've already spoken about it. We have also had discussions on mobile devices now changing the world. It's the same here. So the core market is driven by the large container, Crossref, and search capabilities. There are also a lot of users in the corporate world, single individuals who want to access this level of content through their mobile devices. And it's possible that we can then reach out to these as single title downloads, and such content also is becoming available. Well, e-books in our world are not just Xerox copies or replicas of the print book. And the idea here is not that one print book is digitized and then you provide it to everybody, so it subsidizes the purchase of that title. That's not the motive of digitization and not the end of all means. E-books mean a lot in our world. They are fully loaded with functionalities. They work, they are interlinked at chapter levels. In the e-world, there is nothing called a book in its form as we are used to seeing it in print. It's metadata, it's chapters, it's articles, and they're all intertwined through programming, and then functionality drives it the way the user wants it. All sorts of mobile devices are in use, but these are all delivery devices. You know, they don't really play a role in changing the scenario of the publishing world. DRM, there are various opinions to it. Print, everything is DRM compliant. But in the e-world, you have an option today. And some people are practicing the option, and some choose to delay it, but that possibly could be the future, where content becomes more easily available to users. The other big thing which has happened is it's completely changed the pricing models of content. The way that we price them in the print is no longer relevant in the e-world. And substantial savings are being passed on to customers. A lot more for nearly the same price. That's what is happening in the e-world. There are various methods of calculating return on investments. Of course, the traditional ones are the time saved, convenience of constant access, effect of research output, teaching, and newer models are developing, you know, where you need to then find out what's the student enrollment, how does the content availability in a certain location impact their achievements and successes, and of course, on the faculty side, the research productivity, research grants, teaching. Right. These were elements which were never really looked into in the past, and this is new to publishing, and this could also be an opportunity for people to develop. Alright, the way forward, this is all guesswork, maybe a little accurate. Enhanced e-books with features like videos, audios, platform for live exchange with reading groups, you're already talking about those technologies even when you talk about fiction. Chapter level approach, pay-per-view, the famous slogan at some point will become possible when the viability of such a model is suitable for the business houses who can offer it. Open access, we can possibly deal with it in the question and answers session. There's all sorts of open access going on, gold OA, green OA, and open access, we believe, will become an integral part of a publishing business and would not be something that we have to fight against. We as a company already support it. We also own the biggest open access publisher in the world, which is BioMed Central. And a large number of our new content is also available through the open access medium. Reaching out to non-traditional markets, corporate sales, or this big funnel can then serve various needs that or create various containers which was not possible in the print world. And I guess at the end, making knowledge affordable for individuals.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Sanjeev.
We'll have Krishnan going next. Yeah?
Srinivas.
Srinivas, sorry. Sorry. My apologies.
Hi. Morning. I don't have presentations to give, but I'll just talk my way through. I hope I make sense. I don't know how much people know or have heard of me, so just a brief background. I've been in the publishing business for about 15 years now. The first 3 years were with McGraw-Hill and the rest with Pearson. If I look back at the kind of stuff that I've been doing, it's like, you know, while I've been steady in two organizations, what I've been doing, it's almost like a serial startup after startup. So it depends, you know, how you look at it. In McGraw-Hill, I started the first engineering operations for South India. When I came to Pearson, we first started the publishing program. Then when they sent me to Chennai and said, set up a Chennai operation. Then I came back and started a Chandigarh operation focusing on test prep. Anyway, so, and right now what I do is manage the entire digital P&L, if you will. So just trying to get the whole digital business, if you will, off the ground and give it some sort of a shape. That's my personal story. But I'm not sure how many people know about who Pearson is. So just a few words around that. Pearson is the world's largest education company. Now, the way we define ourselves as education, you know, we have broadly three verticals, if you will. One is core education. But when we define education, it's not just resources. We call ourselves an education company, not a publishing company. So the range of services that we offer go far beyond just resources. They range from, for example, if anybody wanted to aspires to study, say, a management course in the US, you would probably want to clear a GMAT. Who conducts GMAT across the globe? You're a computer science professional. You want to do some networking course. You take a Cisco certification exam. Where do you take? You're in the UK. You want to take a driving license. We do the driving license test for everybody, all of UK. So, I mean, the range of services, testing being just one of it, is enormous. We have world-renowned brands in just about every space, like Longman, Prentice Hall, Addison Wesley, Alan Bacon, you just name it. It's all part of Pearson. Now, that's so insofar as the core education business. We have the whole consumer publishing brand under Penguin. So you must have heard of Penguin, Coffee Table Books around Darling Kindersley, Rough Guides. That's another huge vertical of ours, which is more B2C, if you will, and so it's more recognized by people. And then the third arm of ours is around financial information businesses. So the Financial Times, FT.com, Merger Markets, that's another huge battery of companies that sort of fall under this third bracket. We are reasonably big, about $10 billion in size. But, you know, in India, as I think it's a story that most companies sort of face, that while the operations internationally are big, the size of these operations in India in comparison are relatively small. But the aspirations are big, they say BRIC nations, and I guess we are all guilty in some way or the other in trying to oversell India as an opportunity in order to draw investments and probably get a promotion, I don't know. But, you know, net-net, now when other markets are sort of slowing down, there's tendency for a lot of people to focus and say, so now I want bang for my buck because I've invested for so long, now I need to start seeing it take off. I'll try to slice and dice what academic publishing is from a slightly more layman's perspective. There are sort of two broad segments of players, if you will. There are the independent operators like my colleague here from Sage, which are less prone to the vagrancies of stock market valuations and, you know, investor pressure and that kind of stuff. I'm not saying it's not existent, but to a lesser extent, whereas people open to a lot of these pressures like Springer, Pearson, McGraw-Hill, they are there, you know, the as an investor, what one really looks at is to compare them with an oil company or a cigarette company or another company and say, I put my money here, I need bang for my buck. How do I sustain that sort of a growth and satisfy him so that he stays invested and sees growth is a huge challenge. So that's, you know, looking at operations in one way. And then the more sort of smaller domestic operations, which have radically different challenges. So when they want to scale up, from a small, hole in the wall operation to slightly medium sized to slightly bigger operations, how does one grow the pie and how does one become big? The kind of complexities there are radically different. An entirely different way of looking at it is also sort of the age group and levels to which the academic publishing sort of caters. So you have the entire K-12 space. So that's one genre of academic publishing, if you will, but I guess while our companies may operate in parts or in full, I think we are not best qualified to talk beyond a point, although we know what happens there. I think most of us here, especially myself, we talk everything from K-12 above. And as Sanjeev put up in his first slide, it's a pyramid, the bracket that sort of Pearson focuses in is the bottom most. So you must have heard of C.K. Prahlad, Fortune at the bottom of the pyramid. That's where Pearson's focus almost entirely is. The undergraduate and to some extent postgraduate courses is where we target. I'm less nerdy as compared to Vivek and Sanjeev and a little bit more Janta in that nature. What's happening again in that space, if you will, is can be looked at from an international perspective on the one side and from a more domestic perspective on the other. On the international side, one would see that the business, by and large, this is not a rule, but then I'm just talking about very broad trends here, is moving more from an individualistic purchase decision of products, either by recommendation or by prescription, to something that's more institution-led. Okay, now that comes in various forms, shapes, sizes. That's to give you one large trend. And in terms of attempts to organize ourselves and service our customers' expectations, we try to do what could facilitate a lot of this as one broad trend. Secondly, if you look at our revenue portfolio from a global perspective, from what used to be under 5% about 5-7 years back to over 50% now, the earnings are from digital. So that's, what do you define digital, what for which market can be very divergent, but these are very broad indicators of how things play. Now, within this, I think there's one important statistic that one needs to sort of understand, and why a lot of companies are trying to do different things is becomes meaningful. If you look at the value chain in terms of what value are the academic resources versus the total education spend, resources form about 2 to 5%. So you know, look at your own kids. How much do you pay tuition fees versus what you buy them books for? So if you look at the spend on pure resources, it's about 2 to 5%. Now, the rest, 95 to 98%, is all some form of different product or a service, but all under education. So a lot of efforts that big companies try to do is, how do you layer some form of scalable, replicable, technology driven services on top of what you are giving as resources to sort of get a better share of the pie, because there's only as big as you can get if you're a pure resource player, because the size of the pot itself is only as much. So that's that. Now, if you look at India, the story is something that I guess in some form or the other everyone is really aware of. At one point, educational system in India was very elitist. So the whole entrance exam structure, if you will, acted as a filtration system and said that if you don't score this, you are not fit to get into an IIT or a government engineering college and the sort. But the demand supply dynamics with change in policies has simply turned the table. Right now you have more supply and less demand. So you have colleges everywhere, but you don't have enough students coming in. So what has happened to the resources business when you in response to this? Most publishers invested in creating content that responded to these elite institutions where the students were of a certain caliber. So it made sense, okay? But with the demand supply dynamics changing, what I would call not dilution, but a more appropriate term would be democratization of the educational system. You have people from all walks, levels, backgrounds getting into all sorts of programs, whether it's undergraduate, postgraduate, whatever it is. Now, when that happens, is the same content that you developed for an elitist crowd now appropriate for this sort of a more diverse population? Becomes a big question mark. So I guess there is an interim where a lot of mom and pop shops and small time operators are making hay by giving viable alternatives. The alternatives range in shape, size, form, from kunjis and guides to salt papers to all sorts of services that they could offer, but really servicing their requirement, because at the end of the day, a lot of these people aspire to get a degree certificate because it's going to give them a job. Is an authoritative textbook by a Nobel laureate the most appropriate content for this? It's good for him, but will he even understand? Does he have the inclination to really go through all of it and then reproduce in the exam? I don't know. So these are realities of life today, higher principles of I stand for something and so I will not do certain things. If you have investor pressure on the one side and then growth targets on the other, and then you say, boss, your regular books won't sell, then what do you do? So you've got to sort of innovate here and sort of address what the customer now needs, as opposed to trying to take very philosophical stance. You can't be both principled and profit driven. If you have too high, if you hold too high, hold horses. That's sort of the lay of the land. So, in short, what I believe most academic publishers are trying to do is sort of respond as rapidly as possible to this entire rapidly changing dynamics in undergraduate publishing to early postgraduate, like the MBA sort of stuff, whether it's distance education, whether it's whatever, sort of play the role in trying to meet the customer's demands. Now, whether it's print, whether it's digital, whether it's services layered on top of it, a lot of experiments are out, and one needs to see what sticks, what works, and how we take it. That's my two bits.
Okay. Thanks. Very converging and diverging views here. So let's get a third perspective, Manoj.
Yeah. Hi. Maybe you can call me the smallest out of the lot with size with respect to the company. I am basically a consultant. We have a company called Veda Publishing Consultancy. It's a kind of experiment. Me and one of my friends kind of got together in the month of October last year and thought of kind of promoting more of Indian publishing to a certain extent within this domain. We know the bikis, they're all sitting here, they've shown you figures and all of that, and we also feel that there is definitely a lot of material here. In India, we've got the IITs and people going out, and every third guy that you see in the States and Europe is has got some kind of Indian origin and stuff like that. We also thought, okay, let's why not we also have a little nibble at the big pie. And I have worked with companies like Narosa, Orient Black Swan. We had a startup company which is still in Nissan called Anamya Publishers. Our basic aim was a kind of a little different from a lot of the general Indian publishing happens in this domain, is not to kind of buy rights from foreign publishers and sell it here in India, but do a little bit of a reverse of having Indian original publishing sold outside through publishers like Taylor and Francis and Springer and so on and so forth. Because we kind of realized that there is enough content all over the place, and I'm talking about the top of the pyramid, so to speak, what Sanjeev just showed. So, there is a big question mark with related to hardcore STM publishing, and that too at the high end space, is that there is always a question mark when we go to somebody and you say that you're an Indian publisher doing higher academics or research level, because we've got this tag of you're not good at quality, or there's material which is plagiarized and so on and so forth. There is definitely quite a lot, because in one of the companies we ventured into journals, and we did about 7 or 8 journals. We were very few Indian publishers who published scientific journals. And we basically went and hit a brick wall, because a lot of the material which was given was plagiarized. We were the lucky ones who had access of Authenticate, thanks to Taylor and Francis, because we had a tie-up with them. And we always have this big ego clash with the academicians when you go and tell them that what you've done is picked up from here and there, and there's always a fight, and he's trying to if you're sending somebody who's like somebody like Sanjeev said, that a lot of our content providers are our content consumers. So when my sales guy or somebody is going, he's always under this thought that if I tell him that what you've written is not to the mark, then he says, okay, next time when he gets the fund, what do I do? Will he buy from me? Will he not buy from me? And so on and so forth. So there's always, the Indian publisher is trying to cut in corners, because a lot of the Indian publishers do a lot of distribution also along with it. All the same, given all these kind of little bit of problems, we all realize that the whole kind of, let's say, nucleus of this whole thing is basically content. It can be given it in any form, so to speak. There are enough and more delivery methods and modes that we discussed in the past couple of days. all kinds, electronic, audio, etc., etc. But the bottom line is the content has to be there and it has to be of a certain quality, because if that is not there, you can give it in any form. You know, if you look at a dirty or you know a bad resolution picture in an iPad or in a mobile phone or whatever, it'll always look bad. So I've just written a small kind of piece on how to kind of drive content creation. I just read it out. If you kind of feeling bored and getting too long, please raise your hand and ask it stop. I'll be more than happy to do so. We see, in despite of the current turmoil amongst Western scholars regarding publishing control and pricing of scholarly research journals, academic publishing has tremendous growth potential given the rise in the economic conditions of people inhabiting developing nations. The increasing number of academicians, researchers, and scientists, coupled with great variety and depth of knowledge resources available today, is an indicator of the bright future of this segment of publishing. Another interesting aspect is the ever-growing number of technology platforms for dissemination of information resources and changing market conditions. Now, the three principal participants in the academic publishing industry are the scholars, academicians, researchers, professionals who traditionally create content, publishers who help vet, publish, distribute, disseminate the scholarly content, and readers who consume and access the content, either by purchasing it privately or through their library system. We all know digital communication has played a formative role in knowledge-based societies. The rapid adoption of a variety of social software applications worldwide by people, especially young, is challenging existing forms of communication for learning. I say this because such innovation are allowing the creation, sharing, and editing of content by the users. So we have seen there are bigger publishers who've got a pool of data or content, and they allow their authors, etc., I think Pearson has done that, to kind of have access to that complete content or data bank and create content further. So it becomes much more customized and so on and so forth. As academic publishers remain committed to publishing of scholarly information of the highest quality, and to help this information reach the academic community in the formats of choice, the job is being made easy by advancement in storage, management, and distribution of digital content. Sanjeev just spoke about it, all the various methods. You can sell it as a mobile app, you can sell it as chapters, paragraphs, words, God knows how much it will kind of cut across. With time, publishers will do well to rely on secure, searchable content repositories and high-capacity data distribution networks to reshape their business models and focus on content creation rather than distribution infrastructure, since there are a wide variety of tools that make available content seamlessly to destinations worldwide in whichever form customers prefer. This brings us to the all-important question: who should drive content? Should it be either or some or all of the three principal participants mentioned earlier? I think that to nudge content creation for a new breed of readers with more focused, some say restricted, attention spans, any of the following and perhaps even more approaches can be used by publishers. Involve reader feedback in creating, modifying content. Hopefully most of you remember Advanced Potion Making, a textbook authored by Libatius Borage and used by the Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. The book belonged to Severus Snape, the Half-Blood Prince, and contains a variety of recipes for various potions. Snape, being an exceptional brilliant wizard, even at a young age, had made alterations to many recipes within the book for even better effects. He also made notes of several spells that he had invented himself in the margins of the book. The second way is encourage scholars to move away from writing long-winded authoritative texts and focus on specific and use-oriented texts. For those who are interested in knowing more, Sanjeev can give you a small kind of perspective on this. Springer has brought up something called Springer Briefs. So in the world of research, there is a lot of areas which is kind of evolving very rapidly. And maybe if a publisher goes to him, he might not have enough you know, let's say a 200 page book or a 300 page book for that particular area. But he definitely has some, let's say 90 pages to 100 pages, which is cutting edge. But a lot of the publishers move out of that kind of publishing because they feel that what would they do with that 90 or 100 pages. They bought out a series called Springer Briefs, which is basically small kind of, you know, 70 to 120, 25 page books, which are basically on cutting edge research. And, you know, it keeps kind of evolving on that particular area, and they have multiple. They've got a series on pretty much all the subject areas.
Almost 5 minutes.
So, in my opinion, outside the trinity of creators, disseminators, and consumers, one should not get too worried about the hyper commentary being dished out on how the business should essentially function in terms of content creation, dissemination, and consumption. Like traditional brick and mortar bookstores, online retailers should also be treated as a mechanism to facilitate ease of access to published content to consumers globally and as a means of generating feedback on consumption patterns. Redefining business strategies based on the needs and desires of people who neither create the content nor participate in the financial risk of publishing the content nor consume the content will only lead to a lot of cost prohibitive experimentation. So that's basically a kind of brief on, you know, where we should look at with respect to content creation, the way of delivering it, the different modes. The sky is the limit, actually. That's my little bit of piece. And just to give a kind of, because this was part of one of the topics that was kind of dished out by Leo, was on how to kind of infuse young blood into publishing. So the point is, I don't know, as publishers, I think we are very low key, and we kind of, you know, don't kind of, you know, promote ourselves too much. At least that's kind of my kind of person. And we are very kind of centralized in either Delhi and Chennai. You know, if you look at Indian publishing, I think maybe 90% or, you know, close to above 80% is all centralized in Delhi and a little bit in Chennai. But what about the rest of the country? If let's say, so which is why if let's say there's a publisher in Chennai and he wants to send a book to Imphal, you know, the costs just are so prohibitive that he is allowing that particular order to go, you know. So if we can kind of spread out a little bit more, if you look at IT, it was earlier in Bangalore, and from Bangalore it went to Hyderabad, Chennai, Pune, Cochin, hopefully, and so on and so forth. So it's just kind of, so I think it's time that we should kind of decentralize a little bit, so that, you know, the problems that we were talking about yesterday, that books not reaching Ranchi or, you know, some other part of the country, can be kind of, you know, sorted out to a certain extent. The other is, you know, we've got to come out from this age-old notion to adopt changes. We figure out, a lot of people, you know, when we go to book fairs and, you know, such congregations, that, you know, a lot of the so-called smaller publishers, or in Delhi, like the term Lala publishers, I don't think it's a good word to use, but whatever, that's what we use. Although, you know, he would be saying that I've produced books and, you know, I've got so many titles, but I'm not able to make money. He will ensure that he has an office in Daryaganj. He will ensure that he will never get up from his seat to pack a bag, to pack a box, or, you know, deliver the book somewhere. If he's going to spend so much money on all of that, how do you think he's going to make money? You know, he's either going to give it on rent, or, you know, give it to, you know, to a peon, which, or, you know, if he's saying that he doesn't have enough orders, then why does he need a peon to just sit to, you know, do the packing? If he's got so little orders, he might as well do it himself and save some money out of it. You know, rather than just to be in the middle of things, you know. We hear so many stories of people going to Daryaganj, and if you walk from one corner to the other, by evening you'll kind of figure out what's happening where. You know, there's so many people who just walk there just to find out the gossip, you know, or what's okay, and they go on and they ask you in the, you know, typical fashion that, acha, udhar kya ho raha hai? You know, what's happening there, what's happening? So I think we waste a lot of time on all these kind of, you know, immaterial things rather than actually focus on publishing. And then without doing all that, we come to such congregations and we say, oh, publishing, you know, there's no money, we're not making it, what do I do? What kind of books do I publish? How do I sell it? And so on and so forth. I think it's like, you know, we've got to get our house in order first before we start thinking about if it's profitable or not. I definitely think these are all companies who are, you know, examples of doing reasonably good profits. So I don't think why it should not happen from an Indian perspective. And lastly, why are youngsters not coming? If, you know, the other day I was talking to one of Leonard's trainees who are working with them, and we spoke for about 20 minutes, and, you know, he said, I'm doing my BBA and I'm, you know, right now working with Leonard. I was very happy, and I said, yeah, damn good, you know, you're working, and you know, I hope to see you in the publishing circle and all. So after about 10 minutes, he said, yeah, that's all fine, but, you know, after 2 years, I'm going to go to IT. You know, publishing is not the place for me. Because we're not so glamorous. We don't have a tag hanging around. We don't have cabs, you know, taking us and dropping us somewhere or something like that. So that whole glamour of IT, banking, you know, the place where I stay is, you know, kind of the IT hub of Chennai. I walk out in my apartment, I see every third guy wearing a, you know, eBay t-shirt, Microsoft, IBM. So luckily in the previous organization where I worked, I had a t-shirt gifted to me of my previous organization, Orient Blackstone. I very smartly put it out every time I go out, and I ensure that they ask me, oh, Orient Blackstone, what is this? Oh, this is a publisher, you know. So that kind of self-promotion, I think it's high time we start doing it, you know. So, yeah, but that's just a very general thing of what I said. And yeah,
we
open to questions.
No, I've still got my piece to say.
Yeah.
So the first one is that I should have worn my Sage t-shirt. We got a lot of those.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're trying to... I'm going to talk about just two areas and going to be a little rapid fire. I know I'm equally guilty of becoming another academic, who a publisher who will probably put you back to sleep. So two things. The strengths and the opportunities, I'm going to club them together very quickly, and the threats to academic publishing. So when you talk about the opportunities, whether it's a foreign publisher in India, Sage was originally in India an Indian publisher. It was the brand is owned by a US entity, but the entire operations were Indian. The publishing was Indian. We are 32 years in India and one of the first to actually begin publishing in India. For everybody else, the Indian market was more like a sales outpost. So if you look at just the cumulative, I'm just trying to give you a perspective. If you look at publishing per se in the last 100 years, and whatever the employment that it generated, in the last 15 years or so, we've generated roughly 5 times that employment in the service provision area. Roughly 5 times. So if you look at India today, there is no publisher on this planet that doesn't have a back office in India doing between 40% and 100% of their back office work. And when I say back office, it's not doing their filing. I'm talking about content processing. Okay, so that's the space that India occupies. Very few people have a real window on that. There is no other country in the world that occupies that space. It's unique. The second thing out here is to understand the role of an academic publisher, and that's where the strength lies and that's where the opportunity lies. So the debate that I constantly face is, well, now that you've got the internet and you have got the opportunity for people to contribute and to have their say, should publishers even exist? Should academic publishers even exist? I'm going to talk about that also in about a minute, but let me just classify or rather expand on what Sanjeev said. So what's the role of a publisher? Today, if you have a manuscript, you don't need a publisher. That's the honest truth. In 24 hours, Amazon will have you up and running. Within maybe roughly a week, you could have BookLocker or somebody else give you an ebook, give you a cover design. You're published in a week. Why do you want to stand in line for to publish with Sage? The average wait time is about a year. So Pearson would be the same. I'm talking purely about books. Journals are a different ballgame. But why would you want to wait there? Why couldn't you just go and do whatever you felt like? When Wikipedia first took root, the world said all of reference publishing is going to go down the toilet. And for a couple of years, it looked like that reference publishing was just going to disappear. Because you could go to Wikipedia and you can do anything you want. You can create an entry, you can edit an entry, you can contribute to it. But is that where you actually get valid entries? Even Wikipedia has now got filters which say this particular entry requires validation, requires a citation, requires some kind of other third-party input. And that's been the core role of a publisher over centuries. They were kind of like the gatekeepers, not very good ones. We were the two martini lunches and Havana cigars and all of those. So we were glamorous, but in the wrong sense. It was the top honcho that had all of the trappings that you would want. But the editor, and in those days there were galley proofs and what have you. Those people really sweated it out and didn't have any opportunities to grow. So that has changed. Now within that comes this whole question of, should it be peer review? Should it be public review? So let's have some debate on that one. I can clearly see in there is this Amazon model where you buy a product and you can post a review about it. So great, that will influence the sale. So very rightly, social media is the place that every B2C kind of customer, or even B2B customer, is enterprise is actually looking what's being said in the world about their product. That's great. Would you be able to say the same thing about an article that appears in Nature? Is it enough that a 10th standard student has the right to go up and say that Nobel laureate is talking crap? Does it make any sense? Who's going to police that? Well, should the publisher be the police? Should the individuals be the police? Should we just allow market forces to come into play and everybody can say whatever they want to? If that be true, we shouldn't have arrested the guy who got arrested in Mumbai. We shouldn't be banning a movie. We shouldn't be doing anything. And we should make, drugs or something like that, a matter of choice. So in civil society, you can't be doing that. I know I'm stretching the analogy a bit. But anyway, job opportunities in publishing. Yes, the industry itself is waking up. The IT industry was kind of like the role model, which said, we don't have this industry in India, and the only way we're going to actually get people in is to go out and train them. So publishers are taking cognizance of that. I'm a big brand ambassador at most of the B schools. I go for on-campus recruitments. I give presentations, be it in India, be it abroad, at the university level, trying to fire up minds, saying publishing is not the career you choose when your career of choice is not available. It should be your first choice. So it's an uphill task, but hopefully we'll get there. Now about the threats. It comes back to the whole question of, should there be an academic publisher? And as of 9 o'clock this morning, 12,684 academics have signed a petition which is loosely titled The Cost of Knowledge. Okay? These are people who have signed up and said they will not have anything to do with the world's largest academic publisher. Why? Because that publisher, or those group of publishers, support something known as SOPA, Stop Online Piracy Act, the PIPA, Protect Intellectual Property Act, and RWA, the Residence Welfare Association, the Research Works Act. Now, three very controversial acts that are floating around in the US, huge debates as to what should be in the public domain, what should be in the private domain, what should be charged, and what should be for free. So first we began the internet, everything is freely available. That euphemism of freely available turned into be available for free. That distinguishing line actually got blurred. So the problem is today that you have this whole need, which is you need well-researched, well-documented, well-presented, and very well searchable. To understand content in the 1990s, in 94, there were roughly less than 100 websites. In the 1990s, web content doubled every 3 years. In 2000, it doubles every 3 months. Now, you've got this content overload. Sanjeev was just showing me a very funny picture which says there's 12,000 books per brain. On this planet, you have roughly 12,000 books per brain. And so you would need a brain which is probably 6 times the size that we currently have just to be able to absorb that. So there's such a lot of content. How do you go and find out the content that you want to find out? Well, somebody's making somebody is facilitating that and you're turning around and saying, well, that should be for free. That's like saying somebody built a house, but I don't have a house, so I should have space in there just because he's built it. Look, it's already there. Why can't I get a room in it? I don't think civil society works that way. So I hope that in today's discussion, with at least the perspective that you got, that it actually raises a lot more questions than it answers. I know that some of the briefs that Leonard wanted us to talk about on, you know, can we get books which are customized and all of those things, in the next generation, I don't think that will become an issue. Most publishers are already doing that. An academic comes in and says, I want one chapter of this book and I want another chapter of that book. The publisher will go find those permissions, put together a book that is custom made, and across the board we kind of cooperate. We're not, but we are also, we play a very critical role, and this is only appreciated by an individual who spends months, years, maybe a lifetime putting together the work. For him or her, that's the most precious thing that they've done. It's a labor of love, it's a labor of a lot of effort. And a publisher is basically a protector of his rights. He's not the owner of those rights, he's the assignee. He's been assigned, like a lawyer is assigned to go and fight the case in a court. He's assigned to go and get value for it. And how bad can that be? So with that, with those words, let's throw the floor open for some questions. And I hope there are plenty. Yeah.
My question is for Sanjeev.
Yep.
That in your case especially, what is the life for the new content? Does it become obsolete immediately after the research is done? Because the same guy or the same organization has put up a research which you published last season, and after 3 months there is a new development, the new paper comes and the old one goes out. So you just let it go because
well, research is not like a scientific data book that you publish an update and the previous one goes out of date. You know, the way we understand, please correct me if I'm wrong, the researcher's mind works is that if he's researching on a certain topic, a very scientific topic, then he has to build a reasonable logic around his thought process. And to do that, he has to further research, and you know, you could start at any point if you're researching on a specific topic, but you normally as a researcher go down and dig into the grave of the topic, so you are kind of referring back to where it all started to really understand it in its totality to be able to then create that innovative idea which will make a difference to whatever you're trying to do. That's how, you know, research happens. That's why research requires information which is spread over decades, you know. I mean, if you are researching something in geosciences, for example, geology, say oil exploration, you would need to study the formation of rocks and the elements and whatever data is available in a specific area over a large period. Even if it's 100, 200 years, you would love to read it to be able to come to conclusions that you don't spend billions of dollars or rupees digging into a place where there is no oil, or the whole earth formation itself doesn't indicate over the century that it's like that. Having said that, the citation index for mathematics, for example, is 10 years old. Researchers are referring to articles which are 10 years old. They've not started referring to anything later than that. But in computer science, I may have to eat my words, you know, because it's what is today is already dated, so that's more forward-looking. It depends on the subject.
No, but if you let it go very easily, anybody can trade it. So to buy it again, the same information somebody wants to buy, you do not need to come back and buy again.
I don't think any publisher wants that.
No, as a publisher, we don't ever want to sell our content twice to you, or in multiple versions to you. We want to sell it only once to you, in whatever format you prefer, and that's it. So there is no multiple sales.
Yeah, please identify yourself so that.
Hi, I'm Sangeeta. I represent a company called We Are Virtual. I work a lot with academic publishers, so would want to, from yesterday's topic, bring a little more spice to academic publishing. I think I owe that to all my clients. I really feel that, you know, academic publishing is looked down upon as a very boring aspect, and especially if you've made it that way in the last 2 days, I don't know why. I think it's a very, very important part of the entire publishing that happens. And there's a huge connect that academic publishers can form with the reading habit that we were discussing yesterday. So if you look at the way K-12 is not getting represented here, I wish it was. But if you look at the way K-12 publishing has evolved in this country in the last 3 to 4 years, it's phenomenal. The kind of books we used to have, which was really boring ABCDs only, and the way even ABCD is taught to our kids today is so much different, thanks to the evolving K-12 publishing programs in this country. And then, while those books are written, the methodology in which they are written are actually increasing reading habits. So if I have a small story about independence, and I'm talking about characters, and then I'm giving references to certain books, where I'm talking about, let's say, Gandhi, you're instigating a child to buy more, read more. So actually, that goes on not just in K-12, can actually go down to even undergraduate level, because there are so many references that get cited which make the child read more, and sometimes these references are not just academic in nature, they're to other, biographies and etc. So actually, academic publishing is need-based reading, right? I don't have a choice. While I'm studying, I have to read what my course says. So while that course structure itself is changing, and there's so much hard work being put there to create content which is always updated and incites the students to learn more, and therefore reference more, develop that reading habit, and help the trade publishing grow as well. So I think that's a very important perspective that we should look at in academic publishing. I think there's some really great work happening there.
Yeah, great. The only one word I would say I would like to change in your comment is, instead of instigating, I would say stimulating.
Yeah.
I don't think we're instigating children to do anything. Yeah. The lady up front here.
I think one of the criticisms...
Yeah, could you please identify yourself?
Sorry, I'm Vinuta. I work independently in government.
Sure.
One of the criticisms that academic publishing has come under recently in the light of copyright law changes, etc., is that you're not really able to meet the demands of the student community. Your primary constituency has become the research community. So, you know, like you said, your content creators are your customers as well, who are able to tap into what you're generating at the price that are setting for it. Whereas students don't have the affordability for that content in many cases. And
you want to jump in there? Or
universities,
I'm happy to jump in on that one.
Universities are struggling, in India especially, you know, this whole thing of how we purchase our academic books, etc., a long process, how librarians process it, and how we sell it. So I think that is an area that publishers have to really address with regard to students, because that kind of keeps coming up in the media. If you've seen, many people write columns about why is it that textbooks are becoming so expensive, why is it that journal content is so expensive, and that is something that I don't see any publisher coming out
for
and,
one minute,
and
the
talking
first
about
one.
And addressing why
yeah.
that is so,
yeah.
and how can it change?
Yeah, so let's talk about the negative side of that first. So we've got two publishers who actually sued the Delhi University bookshop for photocopying. And at the Delhi Book Fair, you had this whole bunch of students coming and distributing pamphlets saying, such a loss, such a this, such a that. And the truth of the matter is that, I'll speak for Sage Texts, the cost of the textbook is less than per page cost of photocopying it. So it can't be, so that allegation is absolutely not valid. We have a loss leading a business model there, where we actually look at numbers over a 3 to 5 year period. We should recover the costs. So our a 500 page, a 450 page textbook is priced at 395, And usually, the end retailer is going to offer a 5%, 10% off that price any which way. That's part one. The second part on that one is the whole question and debate about availability, right? I would go back and say, we are trying to make this available. I was sitting at the Delhi Book Fair, and I get this excited bunch of Delhi University students saying, you know, one looks at the book and says, oh my God, it's available. And the other one's picking up the phone and calling a few friends and saying, and I'm looking at my sales guy saying, there's a demand here. Why is that book not available at the Delhi University bookshop? Why? Because the Delhi University bookshop or any other bookshop is not going to keep them. It's more profitable to photocopy it. And this goes back to the mindset that we are trying to change. It all begins with saying that affordability, availability, Indian... I know Sanjeev is going to speak on this aspect of what the cost of the same kind of books are outside and how publishers bring the absolute latest editions and actually make them affordably available in India. And it goes back to our mindset, if nobody is looking, everybody jumps the red light. If there isn't a cop, you're not wearing a seatbelt. It's the mindset. We are not policemen, but we are also guardians of the content. Sanjeev, something about the opportunity in India.
I'd like to reorient my question because I wasn't referring to copyright violations as in the case was in the university. But what I mean is that why aren't publishers thinking of differential pricing models, say for students?
Well, I'm surprised that you say that. What university did you study in?
I'm a humanities student. So
whatever.
Which
university?
I've studied in Manipal University, I've studied in Bangalore University and University of Bangalore.
Yeah, did you ever come across any textbook that you had to buy which was more than 200 rupees?
No, I mean that's...
Where did those textbooks come
from? I'm talking about more in terms of journal articles and also textbooks which I couldn't have bought.
Journal articles is not for mass distribution. Journal articles are meant for researchers who are... There's one Abdul Kalam and he will have only five of his kind in the country and that's where the reading will happen.
That is where the most objection to the price structure has come from what is happening in journal publishing.
Let me take that one on journal publishing.
The factory is that Indian researchers cannot afford their own researchers.
Yeah.
It's
just
not
one.
True.
One
we are jumping to conclusions.
On the journal publishing, let me take that one. We produce 51 journals. Average annual price per subscription for an institution is 1600 rupees. 4 issues a year, 1600, an individual close to 1000.
Mr. Mehra, I could just interrupt.
Sure.
You know, I think we are missing the point here. A lot of studies have shown that when Indian researchers put out their own work, they cannot afford to buy the journals in which, particularly international journals, which their work is published in, which is why the full open access issue has come about. While you all may pay tokens, lip service to open access. The fact of the matter is that it's just unaffordable.
I think
and maybe
that's why we've got it. There's no need for any further questions.
No, that's why Microsoft has reduced 95% of the...
Yeah, we know all that cell phone business, the Zee television, all that we know. One sec, let me ask that question.
And the recent study which shows
let's not resort to rhetoric, let's understand it in the present perspective.
Can I just complete?
There are about 6,000 scientific journals available across the world, which is the core collection. Now today, forget about this print business and this 1930 argument. We go back in time when we want to prove a point in this way. Every publisher worth his salt across the world has digitized their journals. Through various consortia initiatives of the UGC, the Ordinary Accounts for Technical Education, medical colleges, ISIs, undergraduate colleges, 6,000 global journals are made available to educational institutions in the country. There's hardly any research institution or research lab, except the defense guys who are not making up their mind what they want to do. The journals are available. And if you really calculated the cost at which the government of India is today able to provide access to this massive amount of journals to the organized educational environment is peanuts, actually the cost of peanuts. If you cut it down to the level of per journal and what it costs, it's not even 5 rupees. And on the other side, we have people who are going wild telling the HRD minister that it's unaffordable, it's open access, it's lip service. Open access is not free access. Open access is a business model. We need to put together a structure which allows information to survive for the sake of making everything philanthropically free. You can't destroy a structure which has been there for 400 years just because there is some points that you want to make which sound nice in a philanthropic environment.
It's not
it
speak,
doesn't make sense.
It's been paid for by the taxpayer.
So what? So what?
May I just
India
just
can afford to pay 200 crores
no,
for
no,
all
no,
these
the
journals.
Analogy, the analogy that Mr. Mehra gave of a house being taken over. The house has been taken over, and I'm sad to say it's been taken over sometimes by academic publishers. And my fear is that the model from an affluent country may not necessarily meet the needs of a country like ours, which has certain developmental needs.
So let's go find out the realities of today and relate our questions and our opinions and strong opinions that it's lip service based on facts, and let's not resort to misinformation, which is not really what is happening.
The chief librarian and the chief of the InfliBNet project, which is the India's premier digital initiative on libraries getting content, stood up at the Delhi University Congress of Librarians, International Librarians, and said openly before the world, we have saved a total of 99% of the original price of the journal by buying it in this model. 99%. That means the content is today available at 1% of its real price. This is the chief of the InfliBNet standing up and making a statement. It's not me, it's not an academic publisher.
Compared to what it was yet.
He stood up and said, the government is very happy, it has saved 99% of the cost. And this is not a publisher.
If I may sort of stretch this from beyond journals to a little bit around textbooks, I think the whole cost and price conundrum is just bullshit. Pardon my language, but let's take the cost dynamics. Average annual fee for an engineering student is about 1 lakh a year. His spend on books under 2,000. And if people crib that's expensive, they can't afford it. I mean, let's
bring in capitation fee and then everything
Let's talk reality. He spends more on a pair of shoes than what he would spend in 3 years in engineering college for his education by way of resources. So, I mean, this whole conundrum of pricing and cost and unaffordability and,
Just to kind of add to what Srini said was, we saying that it should be cheaper and that's why it'll be accessible and so on and so forth. I'll just give you an example of NBT. Mr. Banerjee is sitting here. Look at the price of their books. 15 bucks, 30, 40, 50. Art paper, 4-color, very good story. How many schools or how many children buy that?
I'll take the example of BOAJ, for example, the Directory of Open Access Journals. It's quite a different model.
No, in the sense that it doesn't mean that because it is cheap, people will start accessing it. In fact, nowadays it is the other way around. People don't want to buy cheap. You go to the NBT go down, you'll find out how much stock they have with them.
You could also argue that Pratham books are cheap and available.
Yeah. So the whole point is, it's not that just because it is.
No, but the point is not that I'm with you. I know that students should be able to buy these textbooks. I'm not saying they should come free or whatever. I'm just saying that this myth is being generated, and I think that there is a space where publishers are not having a dialogue with organizations or with people who are coming up with this and clarifying these points.
We as an association, we do that. We go get onto the road. We actually at the book fairs, we hold these kind of open forums where we want to interact. Sorry? The World Book Fair is held in Delhi. I'm trying really hard. We participate in the Kolkata Book Fair. This year we'll be at the Chennai Book Fair. I'm happy to take it wherever it can go. And when I say I don't mean just Sage. I'm speaking
for
all
the
publishers.
One of the problems that academic publishers in India face is that they are burdened with the arguments against companies that of the same brand in other countries, for example. We do subsidize our publishing here.
It's true that sometimes there is a spillover effect, but what we are missing out is the huge opportunity. if we just change our mindset, if everybody agrees, you know, it's like the music industry. They pay a very small license fee and you can play music over the air, or you play it in your elevator or in your office. And we followed the same model. The IRRO is now functional. For a very small fee, a certain number of content is available for photocopying. But it goes back to the mindset that we have. You know, because I want it this way, I'm going to get it photocopied. I'm going to get, you know, software which is pirated. And the whole analogy can be stretched to you know, disproportionate levels. But yes,
yeah.
Sorry.
I'm not going to ask you any questions related to AMM.
So no. Please feel free. Feel free.
Actually, we debated probably last year here. My question is, you raised a very interesting point that dealing with university bookstore, they don't keep interesting books where you've seen that there will be enough demand. So they come to Pragati Maidan and they ask, oh my God, like, so whether your association can enter some MOU kind of thing, all 500 universities reaching, setting up your, you know, it's a cooperative between you all, Oxford or in Sage and Singer, they come together and they display the interesting titles and all. So, have you thought of it?
The answer to that one is actually the first part of the problem, which is, when is the university syllabus actually, or syllabi, when is it revised? When do new books come in? There are some editions which are 15 years old. They're still being prescribed. Now, the booksellers have got finite space and they would want to maximize, and as a business, there's nothing wrong. They want to maximize that space. You wanna talk about that, Sanjeev?
So, if you're...
Yeah, please, Srini.
See, if you're talking about a book cooperative sort of college bookstore where people can stock and stuff, see, there are multiple sort of cogs in the wheel that will sort of influence and make it or not make it happen. We as publishers can do only as much. You know, at the end of the day, it's a real estate within the campus or near the campus, and then so it's not... It's a little wishful thinking at this point. I think there's a lot of work that you need to do if you want to set up something like that, and it's a long way off.
At least you could take some pilot projects.
If I may, there is another cooperative that's there. It's called Flipkart.com. You know, they make sure that they got everybody's content. It's available at almost the same discount. No discrimination.
Yeah.
Bookadda.com has actually got a space only reserved for students. Only textbooks. So it's entrepreneurs who are actually finding, you know, the idea that you have. As publishers, we may not be able to do it, but there are entrepreneurs who are finding out. Yes, Anjali?
A couple of points I want to make. You know, probably we're not looking at the opportunity as Vivek said. You know, as far as the international content is concerned, nearly 40,000 books are reprinted in India at subsidized prices, lowest possible, for various course requirements of any possible course that you can think of under the sun in the Indian university system. And if you did a serious and a fair research of the pricing of these titles, which Pearson or Royal or anybody else publishes, fortunately my company does not, so I'm not presenting my own case, you would see that the prices of the books were assigned 200 rupees 20 years ago. And after 20 years, they're probably now 250 rupees. That means they have not even absorbed the real rate of inflation in its pricing. And where has that gone? That's why, you know, these are the reasons why the Pearson is so big in the whole world and has no way to increase its business in India. The whole process is completely, this misplaced conception is completely destroying the publishing industry in India before it grows. We have no professional publishing in India. Today I want to buy a business, invest in a business on behalf of my company, and I look around all over the country, there's no one. Not even a list that I can fund, invest, not for profit. Asia is in the news, everybody wants to do something in Asia, just for the heck of it, there is nothing that I can invest in. So the whole professional reference regime does not need open access rhetoric at the moment. Let us at least create the industry before we go open. On the other side, you know, if you look at real serious statistics and the opportunities that we have, about 6 lakh students go away from India to study in various universities across the world. You're one of them. On an average, you spend about 10 lakhs to 15 lakhs per year on your education abroad. If many of us are carrying a BlackBerry here, you open the calculator and multiply those figures, 6 lakhs into 10 lakhs, on a BlackBerry, it gives you an error to the level of E11. That's the amount of foreign exchange India loses for educating its own students, own children. This is the condition, you know, which needs to be debated on and looked at as an opportunity for us. Knowledge today, still 70% of it, or 80% maybe in India, or 90%, is still drawn from books and journals. So what is available probably is not sufficient. It's not just the infrastructure. You need to give the publishing industry the life it deserves and allow it to come up and offer solutions which keeps our students in the country and not drive them away with decorian photocopy elements and misplaced ideas about real pricing. There's nothing. India is the only beneficiary in the whole world of subsidized pricing for books, singular country.
Failure of the Indian publishing industry as well, because in no other sector or product or service category is there this public expectation that the product should be somehow available or offered to people free or subsidized or cheap. I mean, nobody expects that because I can't afford a TV, the TV company should somehow carry a moral responsibility to offer it to people.
I think it's misplaced coffee table philanthropy. What else can you say to it?
Absolutely.
Today, the biggest names in the world, the McGraw-Hills, the Pearsons, the Oxfords, you look at the textbook sales, it's dropping. They're finding it difficult to survive in India. That's the level at which piracy, photocopying is hitting us.
Is it not a failure of the publishing industry generally? Because I think it needs to be more assertive and say that, look, you can't have a product or service at a cheaper price.
Well, if the government was themselves serious, we all file our returns. We are all law-abiding companies. We are filing all details of our financials with the government of India. At 50 rupees, anybody can access it from the registrar of companies. You see the volumes, see the sales, see where the profits are going.
No, there is no growth. I don't think that knowledge is not as important as food.
No, it's not a question.
I think our food is subsidized, our public transport is subsidized, infrastructure like this is subsidized.
See,
and when it comes to our interest, we are not willing to see beyond our nose.
At the
That's
end of the day, we are all publishers, and as publishers, at least most of us most of the people that I've met are in it as business, to set up an enterprise. It could be the job of government to provide subsidized knowledge or subsidized books or something.
I think there's a vision for many people in this hall, and I would like to still believe that none of us are starving. We do have a social vision, and the models from the world may not suit us.
That is a philanthropic side. If somebody wants to pursue it, they're welcome. But a business model has to remain a business model. And if you set a business, then that has to be viable. You can make profits and then give away to charity. That's a different.
Yeah, very interesting. On any last question, and just on the yeah, sure.
Yeah, you were speaking of digitized content. I want to know what the market in India for this kind of thing is. Do you have students in India who are buying your digitized content, or do you provide this for other countries?
For students, anybody want to take that for students?
So it depends. I mean, if you say students of research, yeah, I mean, bulk of their consumption is all digital. But if you say from a classroom engagement standpoint...
But you do textbooks, right?
Yeah, so textbooks are in e-format. But then the textbooks in e-format and their consumptions are... We've barely started.
Let's answer that question with another big real problem in India. I travel to tier 2, 3, 4, 5 towns, right? Here's a place that doesn't have electricity for 9 hours a day. How is digital content going to come in there?
Absolutely.
On that, having said that, my mobile phone doesn't switch off, which means there is a solution. When I say the mobile phone doesn't switch off, the signal service is still available, which means there can be a solution. It has to be a partnership where the government is allowing a certain amount of, you know, freedom to be able to do this. Yeah, it can be argued the towers are owned by the company and they provide the backup and all that. But the reality is, you go to the schools. How many of the schools even have a roof? Even in a place like Delhi or Mumbai, municipal schools don't have teachers.
Precisely.
So
why
before we go to
in that space.
From me personally, if you ask me, I would say that all that I have seen, India is still, you know, many miles to go before we start talking about electronic content if we don't get our basic infrastructure in place.
Yeah, talking about infrastructure, I just want to interject there. On the professional reference books and the journal side, content is massively available in India. We as a company provide access to our entire 2,500 journals to every possible higher education institute in the country through various arrangements, and at prices which are unbelievable. We've also gone to the extent that with the cooperation of the All India Council for Technical Education, for example, if you subscribe to the entire Springer Journals collection, the list price is 2.5 million euros. That's what it's priced outside. And we provide access to engineering colleges, undergraduate engineering colleges, for 1,000 euros per year.
Each college?
This is what we do.
Yes.
And this is what is not recognized, you know. This is the level at which e-content has destroyed the traditional pricing models. And this is the extent at which publishers play their responsible social role in providing access to that level of institutions. Under the ENLIST program of the UGC, we are providing access to 2,400 undergraduate colleges to nearly our entire e-book collection at a price of 0.34 paisa per book. What are we talking about pricing? We are ignoring a very large side of the changed industry which has brought huge amount of benefits to India. Our research output was going down. We were losing. There were national articles in Nature about the state of Indian science. And with all these developments and providing access, now our paper input, research input is now beginning to show up. And we reverse the cycle as a country. I think there are some policy makers high up in the government know what they're doing, and they're funding these initiatives.
This is how the college pays for it, and then students have access.
Yeah,
yes, it's IP based access.
Yeah,
it's an IP based access. And in the ENLIST program, we are also experimenting in a country where we have difficulty growing because of piracy and photocopying. We are trying to give passport based access through an easy proxy process installed at the Infibnet Center in Ahmedabad. And if it's misused, we'll have to shut our shop and go back home to whichever country we come from. But we are risking it because, publishing is not selling a soft drink. It is, you know, a soft business. Our content providers are our content consumers. We can't be harsh with them, you know. That's why it's called a soft business.
Okay, one last question.
Yeah.
We've got three hands for one last question. Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Banerjee.
Yeah, it's...
He's got the mic.
Not a question, but information, because we're talking about the price of the book. National Book Trust India has a very interesting scheme of giving subsidy to the private publishers for university-level textbooks and reference books. This is a very old scheme, and we used to bring out a lot of books under the scheme, but now it's not picking up. So if any publisher is interested for this, we are there to help you. You can visit our website, you will get all the information. I'll just give a summary of that, what it actually is. Once the book is selected after proper reviewing process, the cost of production is vetted. We fix the price. We just fix the price, nothing else. We just fix the price, pay 50% of the cost of production to the publisher, and also take care of the royalty of the author. That's 20% on list price,
not on net price, which no publisher will give, and that too in advance.
Sounds good, sir.
And we regulate the price. The only thing is we regulate the price.
Okay.
Sounds good, but
still
only the timeline is the
issue. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the university adoption process in India, let's not even go there. We won't get tea, lunch, dinner. So, last question, please.
I'll keep the question very short.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead. No, he's pretty loud, I mean.
Okay,
yeah.
So, would somebody be able to explain why some journals published by, say, Elsevier, are priced as high as $20,000 for an annual subscription?
Goes back to various models and question, and the best person here is the next biggest publisher after Elsevier. Sanjeev?
You know, how does it matter if it is $20,000 in print and it's globally priced? You are getting the same Elsevier journals at the same peanut price that I described to you, 0.345 per article through the consortium.
So
fully downloadable, you have access to the content. I mean, how does it affect our life if it is $20,000 on the moon? It doesn't affect our life.
I'd also just like to add, some of the journals, say for example, published in India by Internet Society, are priced about $2,000 for annual subscription. I mean,
excuse me?
2,000 rupees,
yeah,
as an annual subscription.
Yep.
And the same when distributed through Springer abroad, it's about $700-$800.
So you're happy about that or upset about it?
That's fine, right?
Are you happy or upset?
I just wanted to know, who takes all the money? Is it the publisher or the letter?
No, the society is getting a lot of the money.
You know, when I carried the royalty check, you know, when I carry the royalty check to the Indian Academy of Science, I'm the most honored person there. In the company of academics, you know, we in the publishing business, we are very shy. And naturally, we call teachers and professors, sir. And when they start praising you, one doesn't know where to look. Actually, they didn't know which bank to put it in. You see what we've done for them.
Yeah. It's an
unimaginable amount of money we pay out for them. So they don't know what to do with the check. The hands start trembling when we give them the check. It's that big.
The last word on journal publishing, just to put the last perspective on this, when you talk about commitment, for every time a journal is to be published, I have a policeman knocking at my door.
My
so I have 51, yeah, he's two. So I have 51 journals that are already out. We have signed up approximately 61, right? So 51 times a policeman has come to my house, questioned my neighbors. You know, is this the guy who lives here? Is he worth... You know, this thing, you know, can we take your reference as saying that he's of good character and that he's not going to run away and all of those things, right? So, we can turn around and say, I don't want to do that, which is what a lot of publishers have done. But there are others. There's Sanjeev and me, and we regularly have the police visiting our house. So, we've got a charge sheet in our, well, not exactly a charge sheet, we've got a portfolio in the local police station. You know, 51 times guys have visited my house.
Why did they visit your house?
Because that's the law.
But it's academic.
No, sir, would you like to be my lawyer for that one? Nobody is willing to listen that it's an academic journal. We are treated at par with mainstream media. It is classified as a periodical. There is no separate classification known as academic journals. And we are subject to those laws of blasphemy, of sedition, and all of those things, and I personally am responsible for it.
This is covered under the Press Radio Broadcasting Act, PRB Act,
1858, amended 1862, then again amended in 1970 when books were removed from it.
That's
thankfully
how we published scientific journals in India under that law.
Yeah.
My mother worries, you know.
Leonard has already said, you know, it's time to go.
One question, please.
Leonard, with your permission.
No, with yours.
With mine, yeah. Please.
I want to know whether there are any publishing colleges, like you have in abroad, you have for IT, you have colleges, or because I find that a lot of people are in publishing are print engineers or from some other background, but they have just evolved over a period of time. They have not actually learned anything about publishing, but over 15 years, and you're the boss. Like, you know, so is there anywhere we can learn or enroll? Because that's why you don't find a lot of youth going there.
Yeah,
there are a few. Calcutta, Jadavpur, Kerala. Just Google and you'll know.
Yeah, and also Delhi University.
Delhi University.
They have the College of Vocational Studies, which
no,
has a full-time graduate and a
they've
postgraduate
stopped?
Publishing.
They've stopped.
Okay.
Course.
So
but
then I can tell you of two. The first one is under Ambedkar University. There is a project where the entire publishing course of a 2-year course and a 3-year course is being worked on. The curriculum is being worked on. We're part of that team. And then there's something else which the Columbia Earth Centers out of Columbia University, again, we are part of that study, which is evaluating something known as the knowledge project. So how can you actually take, it's a very broad-based project about knowledge information, but within that is the whole system of creating an education backbone of for the publishing industry. I mean, it's a very small piece, but nevertheless relevant.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, time for some tea.